This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Judge Amy Coney Barrett kicked off her Supreme Court confirmation hearing with an opening statement that was all about what the courts shouldn't do.
Courts have a vital responsibility to the rule of law, which is critical to a free society. But courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life. The policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people.
But Supreme Court rulings do affect policy, and Barrett's confirmation would have a big impact on public life. Her addition would make the Supreme Court the most conservative it's been in 70 years, and that shift could have decades-long implications for Roe v. Wade, LGBTQ rights, and the Affordable Care Act. We know you have a lot to say about this nomination, and so do our guests. Leah Littman is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. She's also co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. Professor Littman, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And William Eskridge is the John A. Garvard Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale University Law School and author of Marriage Equality, From Outlaws to In-Laws. Professor Eskridge, welcome.
Delighted to be here.
So, Leah, it's day two of Barrett's confirmation hearings. Has anything new or noteworthy come out so far?
Thus far, there have been some pretty significant exchanges, particularly her opening colloquy with Senator Lindsey Graham. In that colloquy, she indicated that it was unthinkable that Brown versus Board of Education would be relitigated before the Supreme Court, but she refused to say something similar about the Supreme Court's decision in Roe versus Wade, which protected women's ability to have a pregnancy. In fact, in her exchange with Senator Graham, they both indicated that Roe and Casey were not as settled as Brown versus Board of Education was, and they even suggested that the Supreme Court's decision in Heller versus District of Columbia about Second Amendment rights was more settled than the Supreme Court's decision in Roe and in Casey.
So what seems to be the basis for whether this is settled law or not, according to Judge Coney Barrett?
I think it seems to be whether people on the Republican Party disagree with the decision. That is really the basis for distinguishing a case like Heller, which was decided less than a decade ago, and a case like Roe, which was decided almost five decades ago.
Bill, your thoughts as you've been listening?
Well, I think the most significant thing for me is in her very wonderful opening statement. She adhered herself to Justice Scalia's philosophy, which, as she put it, I think accurately, is that Justice Scalia said we need to hew to the law and the Constitution as they are written, and we need to do so fearlessly. Now, the problem is a lot of the cases that Justice Barrett will entertain will not have clear text from the Constitution or statutes. And indeed, the Affordable Care Act case coming up is not based in the constitutional text at all in some respects. And the Fulton case, which involves Catholic Services' claim to being excluded from a government foster care program, involves the free exercise and the state action doctrine, which are expressed in the Constitution at very high levels of generality. So the perspective and framing on the part of the judge are going to be decisive in those cases, possibly more decisive than the political decisions made by the elected representatives and then the written text of the statutes in the Constitution.
Bill, there was a lot of focus on Barrett as a mother and on her family. Why?
Well, I thought her opening statement was very eloquent. She has six siblings, so a total of seven in that part of her family, and then she has seven children. And she very accurately presented herself. She's the first nominee from the Seventh Circuit in 45 years. She's apparently the first Supreme Court justice nominee in history to have young children at home. And I think the point of that was to situate her as a recognizable human being who comes from a position similar to a lot of Americans. She didn't go to an Ivy League law school. She went to Notre Dame, though I think she clearly could have gotten in, and I think probably did get into Ivy League law schools. She's a very prominent law professor before she became a judge, and obviously a very smart person. So she emphasized the perspective she could bring to the court as not ideological. That was, I think, the point of it. But instead, life perspectives that might be a useful addition to the Supreme Court's discussions.
Well, we got this message from Peter on Facebook who says, Barrett's just saying whatever it takes to get confirmed. With such vague answers, I could get a seat on the court. And I'm curious, Leah, how common is it? People may not sit through Supreme Court justices' confirmation hearings very often, but how common is it for someone in this position to be rather vague with their answers?
I think that for the last several nominations, nominees have definitely attempted to avoid answering questions about what cases they think are wrongly decided or issues that might come before the court if they are confirmed. I actually think Judge Barrett represents, in some ways, a turning point, given that her views on some of the most important cases that are on Americans' minds, such as Roe versus Wade or decisions upholding the Affordable Care Act, she has written openly about her views about Roe and about the decisions upholding the Affordable Care Act. And so if she is confirmed, this might represent a new day, hopefully for both parties, where they would actually nominate people whose views on certain issues are well out there in the public sphere.
Well, as you said yesterday during the hearings, Democratic Senator Chris Coons had this to say to Amy Coney Barrett.
Judge, I'm deeply concerned about ways in which your approach to something that may sound abstract to folks watching stare decisis or precedent, that means your approach to reviewing and reconsidering and possibly overturning long-settled cases may overturn some of the very principles for which Justice Ginsburg fought her entire adult life. Cases like Griswold versus Connecticut, and it means Obergefell versus Hodges, which made marriage equality the law of this land, could be overruled just a day after we celebrated Coming Out Day nationally, stripping LGBTQ individuals of what Justice Kennedy memorably called equal dignity in the eyes of the law.
Bill, explain what Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court could mean for same-sex marriage.
Well, I think that is a very good question. Obergefell versus Hodges in 2015 ruled that all of the states must give marriage licenses to same-sex couples on the same terms that they give those licenses to different-sex couples, traditional marriages. I'm not sure that I agree with Senator Coons that Obergefell versus Hodges is in danger anytime soon of being overruled. But I do think what is going to be the fate of Obergefell versus Hodges is that it will be hollowed out to a certain extent by the current court, including Justice Barrett. And by that I mean that same-sex marriages are in danger of being treated not the same as traditional marriages, different-sex marriages, and various exemptions, allowances, or loopholes will be created by the Supreme Court for same-sex marriages not to be recognized on the same terms. And the Fulton case coming up this very term, the court is going to be hearing it very soon, is going to be an example of that, where the justice is going to debate whether a state program, a foster care government program, that uses Catholic Services as a contracting agency for which it is paid, can discriminate against same-sex marriages. Now, the case is being billed as a Smith interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, which it also is. But people do need to understand that there are going to be two issues in the case. One is the state action issue and Obergefell, and the other is going to be the reach of the Free Exercise Clause and how you interpret it.
We're talking to Bill Eskridge, professor of jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. He's also author of Marriage Equality, From Outlaws to In-Laws. Also with us, Leah Littman, assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan. Coming up, Obergefell v. Hodges was the case that effectively legalized same-sex marriage in 2015. What does one of its key players think about Barrett's nomination? Jim Obergefell is next. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. After New York issued its stay-at-home order, Brooklyn-based laundromat Celsius used free Google tools to adapt. they quickly shifted to drop-off service only, enabling online booking on Google so customers could reserve drop-off times. In addition to helping Celsius remain open, it also allowed them to set aside dedicated times for local first responders. Explore Google's free tools for small businesses at google.com/grow.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Rodney Carmichael.
I'm Sydney Madden.
And on our new podcast, Louder Than a Riot, we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
We were hunted by police. We were literally physically hunted. You'd be standing on the corner, drug squad pull up, everybody will run.
New from NPR Music. Listen to Louder Than a Riot.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation and the future of the Supreme Court with Leah Littman, assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan, and Bill Eskridge, professor of jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. Robert writes on Facebook, judges are not supposed to be legislature. They simply read a law and follow it. They're not supposed to decide what the law should be or reinterpret the law. The law is what it was meant to be at the time it was written. The Democrats want the judiciary to be a super legislature, and that is not the role of the judiciary. And Andrea tweets, the abortion and LGBTQ rights issues continue to be a religious fight by GOP lawmakers that get their argument points by incorrectly interpreting the Bible to fit their narrative. This isn't serving people of other faiths. It seems to me the opposite of church and state when laws are created using one's Christian beliefs. Now, Obergefell v. Hodges is the 2015 Supreme Court case which effectively legalized same-sex marriage in the U.S. Last week, Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito said that ruling was, quote, a problem the court needed to fix. Jim Obergefell was the named plaintiff in that landmark case. I sat down with him recently and began our conversation by asking for his reaction to the justice's comment.
Well, to be honest, Jen, I was angry, but I was also incredibly upset that two sitting Supreme Court justices would say that religious beliefs would take precedence over other people's rights. The First Amendment, religious freedom, is about preventing anyone being persecuted for their religious beliefs. And yet, it seems to me that they are saying, opponents of marriage equality, feel free, let's use our religion to persecute LGBTQ plus people.
Why, for you, is upholding Obergefell v. Hodges so important? What's at stake?
Well, it completely ignoring my marriage to John and the right to always be his widower and to have that respected. Why it's important to me is the millions of people across this nation who support marriage equality, the hundreds of thousands of couples who have gotten married since June 26, 2015, but it's also the young people out there who are worried that their right to marry the person they love, whomever that might happen to be, could be taken away before they ever have the chance to exercise that right. Marriage is fundamental, and when we went to the Supreme Court, we weren't asking for special rights. We were simply asking for the same rights every other person in this nation enjoyed. And our relationships, our marriages, should be respected and protected under the Constitution.
Jim, you recently co-wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post entitled, Amy Coney Barrett's Confirmation Would Be an LGBTQ Rights Emergency. Why do you say that?
She clearly is an opponent of same-sex marriage, of marriage equality. She has come right out and said that the Supreme Court was not the place for that to be decided. She is hostile towards transgender Americans. She has said that Title IX should not apply to them. She misgenders them in her writings and in her speaking. And also, coming up on November 4th, the oral arguments in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia will take place. And should she be on the court to be able to be part of that decision, she would clearly add yet another voice, another vote in that Supreme Court on this case, which could legalize discrimination against the LGBTQ plus community. And in that case, a federally funded adoption and foster service provider has demanded the right to discriminate, to refuse service to LGBTQ plus people because of religious beliefs. And she would most likely vote to allow that to continue.
I imagine it's very difficult to feel as if these rights, the rights that you fought for, are at all in question. What is it like to imagine some of these rights being rolled back?
It makes me sick to my stomach. I really can't think of a better way to phrase it, Jen. It makes me sick to my stomach to think that our nation, a nation that was founded under the principles of we the people, of equal justice under law, and the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, would take steps, concrete steps, to take those things away from us, to deny those things to a group of people. You know, the Constitution provided the Supreme Court as, or the court system as our avenue to make sure our rights were protected when the majority was trying to abridge them. Here we are once again facing the prospect that our rights, our ability to fully participate in society, will be abridged by a majority in power. I think that's a slap in the face, honestly, of the values under which our country was formed and the values we have been working toward, you know, making sure we all are part of we the people instead of being a nation of just some of the people.
That's Jim Obergefell. He's the named plaintiff in Obergefell v. Hodges, the 2015 Supreme Court case which legalized same-sex marriage. He's also the director of individual giving at Family Equality, a nonprofit organization that promotes LGBTQ rights. Jim, thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely, Jen. Thanks for having me on.
Now let's turn back to our conversation with Leah Littman, assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan, and Bill Eskridge, professor of jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. I want to bring Leah in here because I think a big question people have is whether or not Barrett's confirmation to the Supreme Court is pretty much a done deal at this point.
I think it is difficult to count to the number of Republican senators who would vote against her nomination to a point where the nomination would be stopped. It is possible that when push comes to shove, the Republicans will ultimately get cold feet at confirming a nominee to the Supreme Court a week before the election, which could very well be the timeline that we are looking at. But again, it is difficult to count to four Republican senators who are likely to stand up and say, no, it is not appropriate to confirm a nominee at this time.
We heard from several of you about what concerns you when it comes to Amy Coney Barrett possibly joining the Supreme Court.
My name is Rachel, and I have concerns about the Supreme Court nominee that they are seeing now in Washington, D.C. A completely conservative court is a bad thing. They want to take Roe versus Wade and disassemble it. They want to take our marriage initiatives, the equalization in marriage, and they want to disassemble it.
Hello, Tom from West Virginia, long-time, lifelong Republican. And my biggest fears about the Supreme Court is that we stack it too conservatively and Roe versus Wade gets overturned as well as other social items. The Republican Party is losing people like me that believe in the conservative value, economically speaking, but socially quite liberal.
Leah, what could Barrett's confirmation mean for Roe v. Wade? I think this is one case people have been talking about the most during this confirmation hearing.
I think at a minimum, it will mean that essentially every state law that restricts abortion that comes to the Supreme Court will be upheld. That is, even if the court does not explicitly overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, it is extremely likely to say that no state law amounts to an unconstitutional burden on women's right to end their pregnancy. As a court of appeals judge, Judge Barrett would have upheld a law that required minors to notify their parents about obtaining an abortion without giving the minors the ability to go to court to seek what is called a judicial bypass, essentially a judicial determination that they are fit to make the decision for themselves or that notifying their parents would not be in their best interests. Alternatively, I think we now have at least three votes, or we would have at least three votes on the Supreme Court to explicitly overturn Roe versus Wade. I think that a Justice Barrett would be one of those votes. Justice Thomas has already called for Roe versus Wade to be overruled, and I think it is likely that either Justice Alito or Justice Gorsuch would be a third. And then the question is, are there potentially others as well? But at a minimum, it means that the court is likely to uphold any law that restricts access to abortion, including laws that close the supermajority of abortion clinics in a given state.
And very briefly, could that have a larger ripple effect when you talk about women's access to care?
Yes, absolutely. So some of the abortion providers who could be closed offer other forms of healthcare services to women, not just contraception access, but also things like mammograms and breast cancer screening. So it will have an extremely large effect on women's access to healthcare, including abortion, but not limited to that.
Well, Ken Emels, I believe there are many Americans like me who have no problem with a conservative Christian on the Supreme Court. The problem is the very unchristian method used by the Republican Party to get her in. They didn't have time to hold a hearing on President Obama's choice, and yet their choice is being rammed through in weeks. How do you spell the word hypocrite? We're discussing Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing and the future of the Supreme Court with Leah Littman, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, and Bill Eskridge, Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Billie Holiday helped shape American music with her voice and unique style.
But her legacy extends way beyond music, with one song in particular.
How Strange Fruit became an unexpected hit and brought on serious consequences for Billie Holiday.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. Now let's get back to the latest on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings with Leah Littman, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, and Bill Eskridge, Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. Elizabeth emails, "I'm so scared for Barrett to be confirmed and that my right to marriage will be taken away. My partner of 8.5 years is a trans woman. We could try and get a regular wedding, but it means my partner has to be misgendered to do so." And Debbie emails, "Pro-life also needs to apply to those alive. Healthcare is pro-life," which leads to this voicemail from a listener concerned with an upcoming case.
I'm Nate from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I hope the nomination process for Trump's nominee for Supreme Court takes long enough that she does not hear the case on Obamacare. Republicans have been pushing conservative activist judges because they want these judges to change laws from the bench once they're in office. And I expect that since she already wrote negatively on Obamacare, they would like her to get rid of it.
Thanks for that voicemail, Nate. Leah, the Affordable Care Act is set to come before the court a week after the election. What would this ruling decide?
It will decide nothing short of the future of Affordable Care Act, including the Medicaid expansion and the ACA's protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Several Republican-led states, with the support of the Trump administration, are arguing that the 2017 amendments to the Affordable Care Act rendered what is known as the minimum coverage provision, the provision that used to impose a tax penalty on people for failing to purchase health insurance, that the amendments rendered that provision unconstitutional. But the big part of their argument is the second step. They argue that because that one provision in the statute is unconstitutional, courts must invalidate the rest of the statute, because the rest of the statute is not severable from the one allegedly unconstitutional provision.
Bill, if the Affordable Care Act is effectively repealed in November, what does that mean? Do people immediately lose their health care? What will it look like?
Well, I think it would be a national catastrophe. The timing could not be worse. We're in the middle of a pandemic where millions of Americans literally rely on the protections of the Affordable Care Act and rely on the expansions of Medicaid, which the Affordable Care Act has facilitated. So I think that would be the immediate effect, that a lot of Americans would be imperiled in their ability to get health care for COVID and other afflictions that they might have. I think the biggest effect of it would fall on the least advantaged of all Americans, and that is people who are working class, middle class without a lot of income, unemployed, on welfare, et cetera, et cetera. So a big swath of Americans who are responsible, for the most part, hardworking Americans who would lose their coverage. I would add to what I agree with Leah Littman is saying, that also in play in California versus Texas, the name of the case we're talking about, is whether Sebelius, the 2012 decision, is entitled to stare decisis effect. And there is no longer an individual mandate command, which was the main attack on the original Affordable Care Act. So I'm not sure that there's any valid reason to overrule or to restrict Sebelius, which people have relied on in a massive and very important way. So I believe California versus Texas is going to be a challenge to every one of the Republican nominees to the Supreme Court to put up or shut up on your methodology. Is your methodology really a neutral textualism that defers, as Judge Barrett eloquently said, to the political decisions made by our elected representatives? Or will you impose your method to introduce a massive change in what those elected representatives have decided and revisited, as Professor Littman said, in 2017, in the very limited way that they did in 2017. So I think this is a massively important case.
Well, we got a voicemail from a listener who thinks the biggest problem with the Supreme Court goes beyond the individual justices.
This is Irma in Grand Rapids, and I want to talk to about the Supreme Court judges. The concept of a lifetime seat on the court is absolutely unrealistic and does not fit our times in any way, shape, or form. And rather than worry about the two judges that have been erroneously placed on the bench, we need to be able to limit all terms, and that would solve all problems.
Thanks for leaving us that voicemail, Irma. And a quick update from the hearing. Senator Chuck Grassley asked Judge Barrett if she'd made promises to anyone about how she'd rule in a particular case. Her reply, quote, "I want to be very, very clear about this, Senator Grassley. The answer is no," end quote. When asked if she committed to anyone to vote against the Affordable Care Act, she replied, quote, "Absolutely not. I was never asked. And if I had been, that would have been a short conversation," end quote. Bill, turning to Irma's voicemail there, would there be so much concern about the Supreme Court picks if the terms weren't lifelong, and is shortening the term even on the table?
Well, Irma's proposal, I think, is very well taken, but it's easier said than done. It would require probably a constitutional amendment to Article 3 to term limit the justices. Many states do this in their state constitutions. Many countries do this in their national constitutions. But as we know, amending the United States Constitution is virtually impossible on any issue that is in any way divisive. So I think it is a very good idea, the idea of having term-limited justices. But I would like to give some historical perspective. the partisan divisions on Supreme Court nominations have really become intense since the Bork nomination in the late 1980s. And I think that has affected hearings and the battles ever since, each party trying to bloody the nominees made by the other party. And so term limits, I don't think, would entirely solve that problem. But I think it would have many advantages of a higher judicial turnover, introducing younger justices, probably a greater variety of justices, and justices who will not be as partisanly unbalanced as what we're now seeing in the new millennium.
Leah, when we look at the Supreme Court historically, have we seen justices' leanings change over time, or do they typically become more entrenched in their original positions?
I think there are some notable exceptions, but more recent nominees tend to become more entrenched in their positions rather than deviating from the views of the political party of the president that appointed them. In the Republican Party's telling, they look at appointments such as Justice David Souter and Justice Anthony Kennedy as examples where nominees have deviated from expected views. But since that time, the Republican Party has developed a much more consolidated apparatus for selecting nominees whose views are much better known to them and whose views are not changing going forward.
Well, Andrea tweets, Trump is counting on Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation. If anyone believes he isn't already planning to use the Supreme Court to decide the election, you haven't been paying attention. If Barrett is confirmed before Election Day, Leah, do we have reason to believe the election will end up before the court and that she could have a deciding vote there?
It is certainly possible that there will be election-related cases that make their way to the Supreme Court. There have already been election-related cases that have made their way to the Supreme Court, and there's just no reason to think that that is going to stop if and when Justice Barrett is confirmed. The Supreme Court allowed Wisconsin to enforce its draconian restrictions on absentee voting in the primary that led to the long lines of voters that we saw in Milwaukee. More recently, the Supreme Court allowed South Carolina to enforce its restrictions on absentee voting in the midst of the pandemic after a lower court found that those restrictions unconstitutionally burden the right to vote. The Supreme Court allowed Florida to enforce its pay-to-vote scheme that has the potential to disenfranchise almost 1 million people in Florida. So there are already election-related cases that affect who can vote, how easy it is to vote, that have made their way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court already has pending several other election-related cases that are similar.
And very quickly, if it comes down to the Supreme Court deciding the electoral fate of the president who nominated her, would the expectation be, or has Barrett said that she will recuse herself from that process?
So she has declined, apparently in private conversations with senators, to commit to recusal. And more recently, in the hearings, indicated that she had not taken a position on whether to recuse. I think it's extremely unlikely, given her prior statements, that she would elect to recuse from any election-related case, even though the president's statements that he is relying on the Supreme Court and his justices in particular to help him with the election and to help count the ballots really do cast a light of partiality around the Supreme Court and how it might rule in such a case.
That's Leah Littman. She's assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan and co-host of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast. And Bill Eskridge is the John A. Garver Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale University Law School. He's also the author of Marriage Equality, From Outlaws to In-Laws. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.